Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
We are very pleased to introduce to you a debut author, Val Berlinski. She's written a very impressive book, The Girl Who Slept with God. We have been talking about it in the bookselling scene here lately. It's been causing quite a stir. So we are very pleased to have her here tonight. So without further ado, please help me welcome Val.
That controversy I'm worried about. In fact, we told one of our, which driver was it? It's like, so you wrote a novel, what's it called? And then there's this moment of hesitation. Well, it's about a girl. She slept with God. So yeah, this book is really, it's true. It's much has been made by my publicity department about its autobiographical elements, because I did indeed grow up during the 1970s in Idaho in a very strict evangelical home. I can hardly emphasize enough the strictness of this religion and of my parents in particular. So in my family, we were even slightly more odd than the other members of our church, which is probably hard to imagine. But my dad was very, very serious and very sincere about his religious beliefs. And he himself definitely lived as closely as he really truly tried to emulate what he felt was a Christ-like life. And he, I think, achieved this surprisingly well. My sisters and I all adored him. And in fact, I would say we worshiped him, which can be kind of good and kind of bad. He was my God, and in many ways, I found religiousness almost a moot point for me personally, because I already had a God, and it was my Father, and I couldn't imagine one that was more loving or forgiving or even more life-changing and important than my own dad. And in portraying him in this particular book, it was very challenging because he's very much in here. This is a fairly apt characterization of him. But at the same time, some of the things that he does, his character does in the book, are fictionalized. And if he were alive, he would probably be slightly appalled to see what he ends up doing in this book. The main characters are two teenage girls, one who's 14 and one who's 17, just like my older sister and myself. And I, the character that I play in the book, her name is Jory, and she is the more rebellious sister by quite a ways. She's stubborn and strong-willed and rather independent and questioning of the family's religious beliefs, whereas her older sister, Grace, is incredibly devout. She sincerely believes everything her parents and the Bible and the church tell her about the evangelical fundamentalist religion. In fact, she takes her parents and goes their thoughts and their ideals and takes them several steps further, which then surprisingly or not sort of frighten her parents. She's become practically a saint, and her parents were not really intending to bring up a saint. They were just hoping for a very well-behaved daughter. But instead, they got a girl who, at the age of 8, tells them that she's been saved and she's going to become a missionary, and she starts studying Spanish with a fervor. And sure enough, when she's 15, she goes off on her very first mission to Mexico. And in real life, my sister definitely did all these things and kept on going on missions and ended up spending 15 years as a missionary in Bolivia, in South America, Central America. Anywhere there were Spanish-speaking heathen, my sister was there ministering to them. And she devoted most of her life to doing that. So what I'm trying to say is the thing that brings about most of the conflict in the novel is that Grace goes on a mission when she's a teenager, comes home early from the mission for reasons that are inexplicable until she gets home, and her parents find out that she's pregnant. And the kicker is that not only is she pregnant, but she's claiming with utter sincerity that she's been impregnated by God. And this is, of course, a problem, because even though her parents believe in one type of virgin birth, they just somehow can't quite reconcile themselves into thinking that this has happened again, and it's happened to their own daughter. So the father, who desperately wants to maintain control of his family and to keep his daughters from being publicly shamed, sends Grace and her younger sister, who's been up to some supposedly bad things, out to an abandoned house on the edge of town where no one will see them as her pregnancy develops. But he is somewhat short-sighted and doesn't anticipate some of the people they will end up meeting, even out in the boonies, and the sort of bonds that these girls will form with each other and with these brand new people they meet. Plus, Jory, the younger one, is now having to be sent to a public school for the very first time. And this is a big switch. She's gone to a tiny little fundamental high school, junior high, her whole life. And now suddenly she's going to a school where the kids chew tobacco and smoke cigarettes in the hallways and drink with impunity and have rifles in the gun racks of their trucks. And there's lots of dancing and carrying on. Typical high school things, but not for her. So this is all very shocking. And it's her first taste, really, of, I'd say, normal life. And her father, of course, had not anticipated fully that situation either. So one thing leads to another, leads to another, and things become definitely more dark and more complex and out of control, really. So I'll read just a little bit, because I personally think authors reading for very long gets really boring. I shouldn't say that, but, you know, if you haven't read the book, you're like, who, what, where are we? So I'll just read a little bit. So yeah, this is the prologue, so it needs no introduction. On the last day of August in 1970, and a month shy of her 14th birthday, Jory's father drove his two daughters out to an abandoned house and left them there. The trip had not taken long. Her father piloted the car with resolute determination toward the very edge of town. He drove past the railroad tracks and the fish hatchery and the rodeo grounds, past the sugar beet factory and the slaughterhouse and the meat packing plant. All the while, Jory stared out the window in a silent fury. Next to her, in the Buick's back seat, Grace was practically unconscious. She lay slumped over with her head resting accidentally on Jory's shoulder, her drool dampening the upper portion of Jory's t-shirt. Jory gave her sister a shove and then turned toward the window. Black Cat Lane and Chicken Dinner Road and Floating Feather rolled past, long, twisty lanes sided with fields of sugar beets and alfalfa and corn. Jory watched a lone mallard drop and skid like a bomber onto an irrigation ditch, while three goats perched King of the Hill style on a salvaged roof a farmer had put out for them. Her father continued on past several vast silagey-smelling feedlots, and then the fields grew even larger and the scenery more sparse and the houses less frequent. And finally, he turned down a narrow, unpaved lane that Jory had never seen before. Then he stopped the car and opened the door. Jory refused to look up at the strange house where she and her sister were now to live. She sat in the back seat with her hands wedged between her knees until her father pulled her forcibly out of the car and set her on her feet in the dirt. The house of their exile was ancient and dilapidated, its white siding weather-warped, its roof shingles curling and covered with moss. And below the sharp peak of the house's second story, an enormous diamond-shaped window stared out from its gable like the Jack of Diamonds' lonely eye. But it wasn't the condition of the house that mattered, Jory knew, as much as its location. The house was safely hidden away on a back acre of Idaho farmland, far away from any schools or churches or stores or neighborhoods. And it was this isolation for which Jory's father had paid. Privacy was of the utmost importance now, he had said. Or perhaps more correctly, the word he was looking for was secrecy. Her father unwedged the few taped-together boxes from the Buick's trunk. One at a time, he carried them up the house's peeling green steps and deposited them onto the living room floor. Jory stood holding the screen door open and taking occasional, unwilling peeks at the dim interior of the house. A brown couch sagged dead cat-like against one wall. The portion of the floor she could see from the doorway was made of sloping hardwood and was partly covered by a gray-flowered rug that must have been bride-beautiful at some point a very long time ago. Jory heard the car door slam. After a second, her sister came wandering up the porch steps. Grace leaned against the door frame for a moment and then wobbled toward the couch, where she proceeded to lie down on her side, her face buried against one of the sofa's armrests. "I think that about does it." Her father wiped his hands down the front of his khaki pants. "Yep," he said, gazing about the room. "There you are." Jory gave him a hard, bright look. "Here we are." He searched for something in his pockets. He whistled Red River Valley and patted down his shirt front and then his pants pockets. "Aha!" He held up a small silver key. "You'll be needing this." He smiled and handed it to her. Without even looking at the key, Jory tossed it onto the top of one of the unopened boxes. "Hey now," her father said in his calmest voice. "You don't want to lose that." After walking over to the cardboard box and retrieving the key, he handed it to her once more, this time pressing it into her palm and closing her fingers firmly around it. "Don't you have another one?" She inspected his face. "Well, Mom and I'll keep an extra, of course," he shrugged. "Just in case." "Just in case?" "Yes, and don't forget, there's milk and things that need to go in the fridge. Also, the front door may stick a little when you first try to open it, so you'll have to shove hard and jiggle the handle up and down." He demonstrated and then paused, waiting for a look of recognition that Jory refused to give. "Okay, well, I'll be back to check on you in a day or two. I think Grace's correspondence course book should be here by then, so I'll bring them along." He studied the ceiling the way he always did when he needed hope or inspiration. You might want to get Grace into bed. The doctor gave her a little something to calm her down, a shot or a pill or something. I noticed. You know, he said, ignoring her tone and marching on, you've got just about everything here. He cast a proprietary glance around the room. I think you girls are all set. Really, I think that about does it. She stood and stared at him. His smile seemed sewn in place. Dad? He stepped toward her and then pulled her head tight against his chest. For a moment, she listened to his huge heart's muffled thumping. Then she could feel him sigh. He stepped back and put his hands on either side of her face. Bending down, he pressed his lips against a spot in the middle of her forehead. Jorianne, he whispered, and then touched the spot firmly with the tip of his finger, as if sealing the kiss into place. She had a sudden impulse to slap him. Jory sat on one of the boxes with her back to the door, and as her father pulled the Buick out onto the roadway, she could smell the dust that drifted up in the wake of his leaving. For a moment, she remained like this, and then with a start, she jumped up and scrambled toward the house's stairway, leaping up the steps to the second floor landing and its diamond-shaped window. Breathless, she hung onto the window's angled frame and peered out. The glass was slightly wavy and thick, but she could see everything below. The sway of a giant willow, the branches of a plum tree set to shaking by old men crows already drunk on its rotting fruit, the steady trajectory of her father's green Buick disappearing down the graveled country road. She watched, unmoving, until the last of the car's comet tail of dust evaporated into the late afternoon air. Then she sank down onto her knees on the hardwood floor. This high perch made her feel removed and alone, as far away as banished maidens locked in smooth stone towers. Forever gazing down, they waited for nothing, for knights who were already dead and wouldn't be coming. The first night, she refused to sleep in either of the two iron-frame beds. She didn't unpack any of the boxes, either. As it grew dark, she covered Grace with a red plaid blanket and then moved out onto the back porch and sat on its wooden floor with a wedding quilt she'd found on one of the beds wrapped around her. 1 John 4:7, Beloved, let us love one another, the quilt admonished in embroidered script, courtesy of Levita Lamar Hicks. John 15:13, Greater love hath no man, proclaimed Eleanor Genevieve Dirksen. Let love be your greatest aim, for God so loved the world, love never fails. Fuck you and you and you. Jory twisted the quilt around to its other side. Here there were no Bible sayings, only endless twining circles, wedding rings stitched carefully in pink and gold thread. She ran her hand over the puckered material. How many days and nights did it take to sew something like this? And did each woman do her own portion separately, or did they gather over a long sewing table in someone's living room and talk as they worked? And why did they do it anyway? Look where it had ended up. They were all dead, the quilt makers and the brides, and their painstakingly stitched words meant nothing. Nothing. She pulled the quilt tighter around her shoulders. Something about the way she was sitting, hunched and small, reminded her of how once, when she was little, to spite her mother, she had hidden beneath a table in the back corner of the public library. She had watched from behind the table's great carved wooden leg as her mother stood in line, checked out her books, and then calmly set off for the drugstore with Jory's two other sisters in tow. Jory had come out from her hiding place then, smacking her head hard on the table edge in her hurry, just in time to see the three of them walking past the glass doors of the library and on down the sidewalk, her little sister occasionally stooping to scratch at something on her knee. Jory was quite sure she had forgotten that incident completely. She glared up at the sky, and the points of the stars blurred together. She cried then, a few big splintered sobs, and pounded at the porch's floorboards with her bare heels over and over until finally, wondrously, it hurt enough to stop. She rocked back and forth, hugging her knees, holding her bruised feet carefully off the floor while her chest seized, her lungs catching at frayed threads of air. She wiped her nose on a corner of the quilt and then held still, listening. The night air hummed with the same happy insects. A farm or two away, a dog barked and then barked again. She was still here. Nothing had changed. What had she expected? She tipped slowly over onto her side, clutching the quilt, and let her face slide against the cool of the painted wood porch. God is love, she thought, for God so loved the world. The sunlight slanted through the screen of the porch, warming her face and bringing the gradual knowledge that she was somewhere strange and that her neck was now very sore. She sat up slowly. Several parts of her body ached from a night on the wood floor, her feet in particular and the backs of her heels. She stepped over the heap of quilt and marched into the house. Jory found one of her tennis shoes wedged under the couch and the other near the front door. She crammed them onto her feet without untying the laces. After one glance back at her sister, she fled out the door and down the painted steps, the backs of her bruised heels burning like fire. The road that led away from the house was lined with cottonwood trees, and little bits of the fluff blew all around her and clung to her hair as she strode fast and faster past weedy patches and fields of corn and late summer wheat. She passed a barn that had faded to an unidentifiable color. A large spotted dog lay panting in a strip of shade beneath the barn's overhang. The dog inspected her. It raised its wedge-shaped head and blinked slowly, but did not get up. Jory kept walking. Once she turned around to look behind her, and still, even at this distance, she could see the house's diamond-shaped window winking at her in the late morning sun. The wind began to blow in short, dry little gusts that she could feel in the sweaty sections of her hair. A large crow sailed past and then landed clumsily on the thick stalk of a cattail. The bird maneuvered briefly, attempting to vary its grip in hopes of a stronger foothold, but quickly gave up and flapped on. Jory stood and peered down the road. A rounded truck, the color of curdled milk, was coming toward her. She stared as it passed her, and then suddenly, with a bump and a sigh, it pulled off onto the road's steep shoulder and came to a stop. She could hear a crow squawking insistently somewhere overhead. The truck reversed gears and backed up slowly to the spot where she was standing. Al's frozen ice cream treats, the truck's passenger side read. Tasty and delicious. The man inside was already leaning across the seat to open the door. Miss your bus, he said, smiling. The truck's front seat was high above her, and she had to grab at the crease-hardened hand he offered down. With a powerful pull, he hoisted her firmly up onto the cab's slick vinyl seat. Well, hello there, he said. He raked his blue tattooed fingers through his ponytailed hair and made no move toward going anywhere. Jory stared out through the windshield at the road she had just come down and then back behind her at the tiny diamond-windowed house nearly hidden in the trees. She could feel the back of her throat suddenly swelling hot and tight with tears. Where have you been? She whispered. Where were you? Well, he said, in between selling delicious ice cream treats, I've been busy scouring the landscape for you. He rested his elbow on the seat back and with one finger pushed a stray strand of her hair behind her ear. For a second, neither of them moved. Then he reached out and pulled Oliver past the gear shift and onto his lap. She sat sideways across his hard legs and leaned her head against his shirt, breathing in his smell. It was the same as always, engine grease and cigarette smoke and something unidentifiable that she always thought of as burned sugar. She closed her eyes. Through his chest, she could hear him humming a song she didn't know. He held her carefully with one arm, and she could feel his muscles tense as he put the truck into gear and then steered them back out onto the road. He flicked the switch on the loudspeaker, and as the truck jounced along, music played above her like a carnival tune from a faraway fair, a tinkling gypsy music as strange as a blue tattoo. It followed them like a long holiday all the way down the road to wherever it was they were going. That's it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.